Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. It is Monday, the 29th of June. It's a holiday week. The Independence holiday is upon us and the celebration of America 250. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But I hope you had a beautiful weekend. It was certainly a gorgeous weather weekend, and it was perfect. The other weekends have kind of sucked. Weather-wise. But this one was just perfect, and we waited and we worked long and hard to earn this perfect day, these perfect days that we had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So I hope you were able to enjoy them in some manner. And I just a couple of things. One is a super shout out to the WAMC crew who just did an amazing and beautiful job with their program that they did on Saturday at the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. It was a terrific hour of radio, very well done, great reporting, great questions, great hosting by Josh Landes, wonderful, all of the news team, all the people who responded, all of the people who talked on mic from the farmers market. Just a very, very enjoyable time. And we thank you if you came out. Thank you so much. If you listened, thank you so much. And it was really special. It was very, very nice, way to spend. I personally was in the car, and it was just like a great way to spend my time in the car, looking at the beautiful day and listening to good radio. So that was a lot of fun. So kudos to that wonderful team who put that together. Also, we want to tell you about this special that starts today, speaking of America 250, and that is We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250. It is a four-part special that begins today. All four parts will air in the 11 o'clock hour, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday, we are off for the holiday. And it is a pretty special series. I think it's a very special series. And when we came up with this idea, I immediately said, I got this idea. One thing that I've learned in politics lately is get people who really know what they're doing to help you. Like, for God's sakes, if you're going to let somebody do something, let them be the top and let them know what the hell they're doing. Well, so I figured if I was going to do something on the Constitution, on the Declaration of Independence, on America at 250, I had to find somebody who knew what the hell they were doing. So I got our constitutional scholar, our in-house constitutional scholar, Bo Breslin, and asked him if he would help curate the special with me. So Bo and I worked on this project, curating and hosting, and we made up a list.
We did.
A list of mic three there. There you go. Just press that button. There you go. We figured out like what we wanted, and then we put out a whole bunch of invitations, and I think 8 out of 10 said yes.
Yeah, it was among the greatest professional experiences of my life, Joe.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
It really was.
Bailey, can we get Bo's mic is just a little bit off, and I don't know why. There we go. Okay, say that part again.
It's among the greatest professional experiences of my entire career.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. We got to talk to amazing people. Today, Rick Atkinson will be on with Bo and Ed Gordon Reed. Bo will interview later in the week. Tag team unto Declaration of Independence historians, and then Ron Chernow is on Thursday's show, and we had a lot of fun putting it together. So we look forward to having you hear it today, or whenever you can listen to it. It'll be online, WAMC.org, or you can listen to it at 11 o'clock this morning. All right. And thank you, Bo, for you doing an amazing job. And it was really a lot of fun. And I say this as if it's all done and in the can. The first one is. We'll work on the others as time goes on. All the interviews are done. That's good. All right. Let's start and welcome the crew. And beginning with Bo Breslin, Joseph Palamountain Jr., Chair in Government of Skidmore College. And Bo, what should we know about this day in history?
Yeah. So yesterday, Joe, June 28th, 1776 was the day that the Committee of Five, right, the folks who were charged to draft the Declaration, handed their final draft to Congress. 29th and 30th were a weekend, so they didn't participate. But what's interesting about the draft as it went to Congress on the 28th is it was considerably different. The Congress will cut out about a third of the draft that nobody knew that, except the committee, nobody knew that Jefferson was the author. It wasn't until 6 or 7 years later that Adams tells people that Jefferson is the major author. And the one piece that is super interesting to think about, and I'll stop here, was that Jefferson included his longest indictment against King George III was an indictment about how King George III was perpetuating the slave trade. And because South Carolina and Georgia didn't want that in, and the Northerners who were participating in the commercial activity around slavery didn't want it in, it gets edited out on July 1st. So the document would have been completely different, completely different if that slavery passage had stayed in.
Bo, why do you think Thomas Jefferson wanted that passage in?
Yeah, so Jefferson, I think he's throwing everything at the wall and hoping everything sticks.
Yeah.
The other thing that is super fascinating, and I'll just stop here, is that Jefferson worried, right? He's got all of this statements about how slavery is immoral throughout his career, but he worried that the value of enslaved persons would decrease if they continued the slave trade. So it was a commercial activity. If you have too many people, you
supply
can't
and
trade
demand,
them.
Yeah.
Well, all of these cool things to learn, and we will continue throughout the week of learning these cool things. Also with us, the voice you just heard, Ambassador Fred Hoff, former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years. Now, a senior fellow at Bard's Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Donna Welton joins us, diplomat in residence at Bard College. She retired from U.S. Foreign Service in 2025 after over 30 years in public service. Her last post was ambassador to the Southeast Asian country, Timor-Leste. Two ambassadors on one show.
Yeah, but only one real ambassador. That's Donna.
Really?
Define real.
Senate
confirmed ambassador.
That's a real ambassador. You're confirmed.
I see this 100% with all truth and honesty, but if you told me, like, when I was 17 and starting my broadcasting career that I'd be doing a show with two ambassadors, I'd be like, yeah, okay. I figured I'd have, you know, like a Muppet and a voice from The Simpsons. That's what I would have thought I would have had. So it's an absolute honor to have these two individuals.
That's
also, thank you. Also an honor to have Mark Whitman with us. Mark is a Wall Street investment banker, a dear friend of this program, and we're thrilled to have him here as always.
If you told my parents years ago that I would be involved with two ambassadors, they would have assumed that it involved a night of drunkenness and misbehavior in a foreign country.
You know, choose your own adventure, right?
Yeah.
It's wonderful to have
you.
It's wonderful to have you all here. Thank you very much on a special week and a special day, and we thank you all for being part. All right, let's go to, as I said, the news of the day, and a lot happening in the world as always. We're going to talk once again. We'll talk about the Strait of Hormuz. We'll talk about about peace talks and how things are going. U.S. and Iran are set for new talks. And Qatar, according to President Trump, he said the negotiations, or the discussions rather, will take place on Tuesday after the U.S. and Iran exchanged strikes over the weekend. Iran did not confirm the talks, but said consultations with Qatar were continuing. That's what we know at the moment. And four officials familiar with the negotiations said the talks were not expected to include senior political leaders like Vice President J.D. Vance, who led the previous round of negotiations in Switzerland a week ago. Iran did not confirm, as I mentioned, that talks in Qatar would be held this week, but said consultations with the government there, which has been one of the main mediators between the U.S. and Iran, were continuing, as I mentioned. The discussions will take place as doubts persist over whether the two countries can reach a lasting agreement to end the war. The Trump administration's truce with Iran that was signed this month largely delayed talks on some of the most sensitive issues, including Iran's nuclear program, for a later stage. Okay. Can I ask a dumb question?
There are no dumb questions.
Okay. Is it still a truce when we're striking one another?
I have the same question. Is it a ceasefire if we're firing and haven't ceased?
Right.
Right. I think the MOU, of course, was just a plan.
Memorandum of Understanding.
Right. The Memorandum of Understanding, which is a very unusual term to use in agreements between two sovereign governments. Or, you know, usually it's something, you know, for a Memorandum of Understanding to sell a piece of equipment to. So I think that it... is very ambiguous. It's just a plan for the real talks and a way for both sides to de-escalate without losing a tremendous amount of face. I don't think that it's going to... I don't think going forward we're going to see much different activity. There's going to be, you know, a push and an escalation, which is Iran's way of sending a warning. I think this one over the weekend was more a warning to Qatar and the other regional powers that Iran is a player. And Qatar, you are holding billions of our dollars, and we want you to release them and stop playing around. That, you know, we need to talk amongst ourselves. The Iranian foreign minister was in Iraq over the weekend proposing that the Gulf states, Iraq and Iran, meet to negotiate a regional security agreement. So I think this was just a warning salvo also to Oman not to be in the United States pocket. Because they fired on a Qatari tanker and it was in Omani territorial waters. Not a ceasefire.
Yeah, I think the traditional meaning of the term ceasefire means that the shooting stops. Period. The only practical difference really between a ceasefire and an armistice is open-ended. Ceasefire is quite often has a designated number of days assigned to it. What we're dealing with right now is on and off violence that's likely to continue indefinitely, certainly through the 60 days where a final agreement is supposed to be reached. Those 60 days will likely be extended, but there'll be outbreaks of violence now and then anytime Iran believes that its domination of the Strait of Hormuz is being challenged by anyone. I agree that the Memorandum of Understanding is very vague in parts. It lays out what the parties are supposed to be negotiating in the future in terms of a final agreement. But I would point out that Article 5 is quite specific, and I'm really surprised that Iran was able to get this out of the United States. It says, in part, upon the signing of this MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, the Islamic Republic of Iran will make arrangements using its best efforts for the safe passage of commercial vessels with no charge for 60 days only from the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and vice versa. Why a country, and I refer here to the United States, that has had freedom of navigation as a basic tenet of American foreign policy from the beginning would agree to this, I don't know. Clearly, President Trump wanted to wind things down. He wanted the strait opened. He wanted oil prices coming down. But it strikes me that this is a big price to pay, and we're going to be reminded of this price periodically.
Can I ask Fred a question?
Yes, of course.
Being an expert in the field, Fred, one thing I have not been able to figure out is why didn't Iran realize or act on its power over the strait until now? Like, clearly they could have done something, especially with Israel and Hezbollah, or why this moment? Did they just kind of realize, oh, I've got this power?
Yeah, I think they've known that they've had the power from the beginning to interdict shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. I think they probably calculated until recently that if they tried it, this would bring the full weight of the American military, Israeli military, other militaries perhaps, down on their heads. After the beating they took last June, I think they finally came to the decision, hey, if this starts up again, this is our only real deterrent. We have nothing else. We have no nuclear weapons. We have nothing that's going to slow down anybody who really wants to hit us. This is it. I think that's a decision they made shortly after June 25, when they took a real beating from us and the Israelis.
Right.
I want to hear from both our two other panelists. I just have a quick question about this of the story that I just read of the talks that are taking place tomorrow. J.D. Vance is not going to be a part of them. I don't know who is. I assume it's Witkoff and Kushner. I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, the way negotiations take place in a normal times, and I'm saying that as a caveat, is that the big names don't participate in the technical discussions. So my assumption is that the discussion in Qatar is more about the technical ways they're going to handle Strait of Hormuz and safe passage.
And I suspect this will require more than Messrs. Witkoff and Kushner.
Yes.
We shall see. Mark Whitman.
I think part of the answer to Bo's question is when we talk about who changed their mind, Ayatollah Ali Khomeini is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what took place. He had an adage reportedly inside of Iran, which was no peace, no war for years and years. And I think the Iranian military now sort of runs the show along with the short beards, as I call them, the less powerful younger clerics now. And I think you've seen a change in their disposition. They've proven out the concept. I think the concept wasn't proven that you could indeed gum up the Strait of Hormuz and live another day. The answer is the first generation of the older generations of leaders didn't live another day. But I think now the new set believe a couple of things. One is that Trump's unlikely to go after them again because it just delays sort of the situation settling down. He's got a time frame that's the midterms and calming oil prices and other economic prices down before the midterms. And I think the Iranians are clearly using that against Donald Trump, which is why they've decided over the weekend to assert their will militarily. I also think, Joe, there's a practical implication around ceasefires, which is you're just seeing what it is both sides want to agree to, which is they don't want to be in an all-out war now. They want to be in sort of this low simmer of conflict along with negotiations. And I came across a story this weekend that I thought I would read, which is the following. I'll just give you a little snippet. After a week of brinkmanship, U.S. and allied warplanes carried out limited strikes against air defense targets, framing their action as a response to repeated violations of international demands. The operation was deliberately narrow. Officials said the goal was not a broad campaign, but a quick low-key signal. I could go on and on. I changed that a little bit, but that's a verbatim quote from the Washington Post in the wake of the first conflict in Iraq. Yeah. Now, we are back in that sort of low simmer situation without the prospect of boots on the ground to finally solve our disagreement over what weapons they have, don't have, or might use. And we are in a much weaker position. We don't have a coalition anymore. We have Donald Trump has done what he's done with China, which has helped our enemy prove out their best weapon economically against the United States and the rest of the world. We've also depleted the stocks of weapons that we can use to enforce our will. So unfortunately, Donald Trump has worked himself into into a terrible situation. It's going to look a lot like post Gulf War I Iraq, but we're going to have a lot less of the balance of power in our favor because of the miscalculations that Donald Trump and the Israelis have made here.
Yeah, and I don't know that a term has been invented yet to describe what we actually have. Maybe your suggestion of low simmer will do it, because I mean clearly we don't have a ceasefire. what we have is mutual agreement that the tempo of military operations will be reduced over a given period of time. That is not a ceasefire.
No, but we saw.
I don't know what it is, and maybe some of our listeners can.
But we've seen
analogies.
We've seen analogies of this in 2000 and the 2016 timeframe with Russian and Ukraine. This whole claim that Donald Trump said, "Well, the Russians would never take Ukraine if I was president." Well, he was president the first term while they were in the Ukraine, right, fighting, but at a sort of a low simmer. And if you look at the Cold War, right, when the Soviet Union marched into various countries, it's this same sort of just we're going to get it under the radar.
Gray zone.
Yeah.
Well, and even more recently, I mean, there's been a ceasefire in Lebanon since November 2024.
Right. There you go.
And in the meantime, 1.2 million people have been died, displaced.
Mm-hmm. So a ceasefire with firing is actually, in my mind, more the norm.
Yes. Right. Okay. Yeah. Bo.
Yeah, a couple of quick things I'll say about this. One of the things that I find interesting is we're 20% into the 60-day quote-unquote ceasefire, right? It was signed on June 17th.
Correct.
We're now 12 days later, and I mean, the three of you and Joe, tell me I'm wrong, I think we're probably in a worse place than we were on June 17th. So I think that's interesting. The other thing that I think is fascinating, look, I'm well aware of A, my own ignorance on this topic, and B, that it's way more complicated than this. But I found it fascinating that in the last 24 hours, the two sides have come out with official statements on how what they've gotten from the other side. But neither of them have confirmed. So the U.S. says the Strait of Hormuz official says the Strait of Hormuz is back open. Iran hasn't confirmed that. Iran says the $6 billion sanction relief is on its way. The U.S. hasn't confirmed that. This is where I'm going to be a little cynical, like, and I'm maybe because I'm a parent, like, what? Why? Like, at the end of the day, these are children having conversations about. You know, like, can I outdo one person, one country or another? And it occurred to me, the last thing I'll say on this is I looked it up as I was before the show. Use of organized violence as a solution. You guys, the four of you, have to tell me if this is a rise, but it is shocking. Up to 50 armed conflicts by official government actors currently in around the world. Up to 50. An additional 40 insurgents by non-state actors. So if you add the 50 and the 40, 90, that's roughly, now some of those are double dipping, but 90 countries in the world are having some sort of violent conflict right now. That has to be a high watermark. Half the world.
Yeah.
So, and the most dangerous ones, the most deadly ones, are the ones that you guys are experts in, right? The most deadly ones are Lebanon, Gaza, but Ukraine is in there, Sudan, Myanmar, Pakistan, Afghanistan just got in a fight in the last 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The use of violence is something that I think, probably as a high watermark, and shame on everybody for using violence as the first order of business.
Could I ask a question to the ambassadors? So my favorite question to ask myself about this whole conflict is, if I woke up tomorrow morning and found myself in the Oval Office, what the blank would I do?
You'd find your way out pretty quickly.
Yeah. But the question is,
this is the definition of a nightmare.
Yeah, but what do we do from here? What should we be doing from here? The Wall Street Journal says
we should be building coalitions and alliances of people throughout the world to solve problems that cannot be solved unitarily.
I mean specifically with respect to Iran. And the coalition thing seems a little. We had one partner who we're now calling all sorts of names, and they're going to call us all sorts of
that's us. What I mean.
They would call us more names if there weren't an election pending over there, but they're being more behaved than they might otherwise be.
I still think that there's no solution to this particular conflict unless it's done by a group of countries with interests in the area. And so, what I would do. I mean, I would start a separate quiet channel for discussion with Iran, but that would require that both sides would be respectful of diplomatic and each other's interests.
But say you had a phone line, no problem. They'll talk to you whenever you want. Then what? I mean,
then you set out practical means to restore trust and confidence. To bring down the conflict, to de-escalate. I don't know. Fred,
de-escalation may not be an option here. Mark, if you woke up in the Oval Office, I hope what you would say to President Trump is, Mr. President, as our commander-in-chief, your first responsibility in this context is to keep this international waterway open. You're going to need partners to do this, all right? Our European allies are somewhat reluctant to participate because they were not in on the ground floor of this. They were not consulted. And now we've just had the Secretary of State in the region basically doing an apology tour to our Arab partners, saying, hey, I'm here to consult with you. We didn't do it up front, but I want to assure you that your views are very, very, very important to us. But for me, and look, I am certainly not advocating another round of open-ended warfare with Iran, but keeping the Strait of Hormuz open as an international waterway, I think, is a central facet of American foreign policy. And if necessary, it's worth fighting for.
That's the Wall Street Journal had a... editorial, maybe you saw it today, that basically said the same thing.
Did not.
My only question to them was, all right, do you have enough armaments or projectiles to enforce that?
Yeah.
I don't know what that
is. It doesn't need to be enforced with militarily, though. I mean,
pretty please or pretty pretty please? How do you get the Iranians to change their mind?
We have billions of your dollars, and your country is going downhill fast. And if we can work out a deal, but there has to be a lot more from your side to make this work.
So I am where the two of you are, which is I would choke them economically and I would threaten and use what I could militarily. But the big problem that Trump has is he's got the deadline of the midterms. And that goes back to his first failing. He never got the American people on board with this.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
If we were all on board, if this
were
our project,
was working before. I mean,
sorry?
it's not like the Strait of Hormuz was closed.
I'm not saying he won.
Yeah.
I'm not. My whole point every time I look at this problem is try not to look back because there's an endless catalog of mistakes, right? And to me, it goes right back to the day after the election where I literally almost cried on air. I now think I just should have. That would have been the better response in retrospect, right? The mistakes go way back in terms of putting this guy in charge. I don't care if he tears down the West Wing. I care what he's doing in the Gulf and in the Middle East. And we're seeing the consequences of all those mistakes. But the question is, what do you do now?
So this is the tragedy of underestimation, right? Because I think ultimately the Trump administration or Trump himself underestimated. That's why I asked you folks about, you know, why didn't Iran use its superpower before this? Because I think they underestimated the response from Iran. And I think what's going to, Mark, if you ask me, if I just imagined you as president, not Fred.
That's what I meant.
Fred's got you as
Fred has been cleaning the carpets.
Advisor, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Joe,
you're killing me.
Don't be so sure that's not what happened.
I figured he was going to be president, but under the other scenario, I think like the first thing you would say is, "Do you need help with your bags?"
Yeah. Fred demoted him.
Do you want ice with that diet?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
But what's interesting is, Fred, and this goes to the Fred, what you said early on about Article 5, right?
Yeah.
The thing that. So you want to keep the strait open. So true. Isn't it? Do you think it's not possible that the Trump administration or Trump himself will do this? But do you think somebody's got to cry chicken, right? There's got to be a moment where you have to have some humility as opposed to hubris and say, look, somebody's going to lose this standoff. And to keep the strait open, we have to lose the standoff. That strikes me as antithetical to most foreign policy, regardless of administration. But I think that's the only off-ramp, is somebody's got to say chicken.
Well, the good news
I'm just afraid, Bo, if we lose this one now, if we take the off-ramp now, if we concede now, we will have conceded forever. And this problem will resurrect itself multiple times in the future. I think the line really has to be drawn now, and I really regret the position the President of the United States has maneuvered us into in all of this. It is it's one of the worst incidents of statecraft I've seen in my entire life, but we are where we are here.
Two things, Bo. I do think in terms of chicken, we in Iran were driving at each other in vehicles, playing chicken. Now we've just gotten out of them, and we're playing chicken chest to chest, sort of swinging at each other. No, but we're not. Back to the issue we're at a simmer. By the way, I think your view that if this persists, that we see it crop up again and again in the Gulf is incredibly optimistic. Because if the Iranians get away with it, the Houthis are going to sign up next, and everybody who's got drones near a waterway on this globe is going to sign up for send me an email if you want to pass by safely and buy some insurance.
The Chinese will draw lessons
from this. So I think this goes back to Trump's initial flaw. We never should have done this, but if we did, he needs to ignore the midterms and get all of America either on board or proceed anyway. Right, because the cost of not doing this improperly is going to be more severe than the cost of nipping this in the bud now, even though that will be sadly painful.
I think we're beyond nipping it in the bud.
But my point is nipping it in the bud in terms of we got to tell the Iranians, no, you're not charging a toll for the Strait of Hormuz. By the way, the Houthis were doing it for about a year or so. You used to send them an email if you wanted to get by safely. Donald Trump bombed them for a month and claimed he had opened it. He hadn't. Nobody except those sending emails and payments effectively were the ones going through anyway.
It's like piracy.
It's
the same thing.
Right. Well, back to Fred's point since the inception of this country.
Let's go to Tripoli.
So let's take a break. We'll go to Tripoli and take a break. We'll continue our conversation right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we always welcome your letters And like to have you a part of the conversation as always. Let me see what we have here. The panelists don't understand American empire is in decline. So now live with rather than still trying to be. I should have pre-read this. Of the world. So to do it, to make the Americans live nasty and short.
Brutus nasty.
I'm just reading words. I apologize.
No, that's all right. But I mean, I think empire is an interesting question to talk about. Yeah. Because the nature of American empire, particularly after World War II, was not territorial. And so the decline that you feel in empire is a decline in influence. I mean, we still have bases all around the world, and we still have the opportunity to exercise our influence based on our values, based on a system of, you know, prosperity that we've put forth in the world. But when that's been degraded, as we've seen over the past year or more, then our empire is in decline.
And I've said this on the show, Joe. There are at least four markers of American hegemony. I would call it American hegemony. Militarily, we're still the biggest on the block. Commercially or economically, China's catching up, but we're still a major player. Politically and morally, that's where we're in decline. Politically and morally.
Oh, I think on the first two, number one, I would say to militarily, I would say drones. I put an amendment in that, which is huge. I think China now has got to think about Taiwan very differently. I think we have to think about our power. Look at the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. And economically, we've ceded a lot of that voluntarily by our economic might by what Donald Trump has done. He's basically given away a big chunk of our potential economic might.
I'm not. I don't disagree, Mark. Completely. I completely understand. But no matter what, countries still have to deal with the dollar and with our economy.
Fair.
I certainly think when it comes to soft power, the ability to attract, the ability to persuade, this administration has unilaterally surrendered to our enemies.
Yeah.
On this, and this is regrettable. I must say, whenever I hear somebody start to rant and rave about American empire, American imperialism, nowadays, I don't know if this is coming from the MAGA right or the so-called progressive left.
Yeah. Okay. Another letter, this one with verbs. our oil reserves, writes CJ, our oil reserves are becoming dangerously low. $6.8 a gallon are close by in global depression. Trump is incompetent if he doesn't side with Bibi. The Zionists may kill him if he continues the Zionist requirement. We are in serious trouble. We are facing global disaster. This is urgent. Does anyone disagree?
I don't agree or disagree. I don't understand the question or the assertion.
The idea that we are
mental note, verbs don't solve everything.
Yeah. The idea that we are being driven by Zionists suggests that the writer has a problem that perhaps ought to be addressed.
Yeah.
Judith writes, don't forget at one point Trump was talking about taking over the Strait and that he would charge a fee.
True.
Yeah, presidents had a lot to say on a variety of subjects.
Then we go to... all right, this is a question about another story that we're going to come up on in just a few minutes, so I will hold that one. Let's move on if we can, and we, again, welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I usually read these, but I forgot. haven't done it in a while. Please pre-read your letters. That's all. That's always cool. Pre-read your letters. You know, beginning, middle, and an end is cool. And no links, and keep them short and to the point, and that way we can get to as many as possible. Thank you very much. Let's go to this, and Fred, I don't want to shortchange you. We've got about 6 minutes, but we can certainly come back on this when we return. Secretary of State Marco Rubio acknowledged that an agreement marked only, quote, the beginning of negotiations between Israel and Lebanon. In a small step, Israel agrees to withdraw from two areas in Lebanon. You had a part in this?
Indirect at best.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay, I think that's I don't want to speak for the group, but I think that's probably more than most of us did. Yeah. So
I think Fred's being very humble.
Very pretty modest, yes. Yeah. So let us tell us what happened and sort of what that was like to.
Sure, just by way of background for listeners, because not everybody follows Israel-Lebanon as obsessively as I do. But the day after the Hamas atrocities back in October 2023, Iran's proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah, opened fire on northern Israel. And it's been a violent catastrophe ever since, with southern Lebanese and northern Israelis, civilians, bearing the burden of death, displacement, injury, terror. And today, Israel occupies much of southern Lebanon. So, on Friday, United States, Israel, and Lebanon signed an agreement that they called a trilateral framework. Like the famous MOU with Iran, it has 14 points. It's short of a peace treaty. The aim of the agreement, which was driven by the United States, is to stop the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is not a party to the agreement. It's opposed to it. But the United States is trying to establish a process for Lebanese army units to gradually replace Israeli army units in southern Lebanon until the Israeli army is on its own side of the so-called blue line, the border. So over the last year, I've been involved in an unofficial, and I want to stress this, unofficial, got no contact, no connection to the U.S. government these days. But there's been an unofficial European-supported effort to build a foundation for Lebanon-Israel cooperation in ending violence so that northern Israelis, southern Lebanese can live in peace. My Canadian colleague and I have listened carefully to a wide range of Lebanese and Israeli contacts, and we were able to produce a draft security agreement for the two governments and for the United States to consider. The agreement that came out that was signed on Friday is not what we drafted, far from it, but it draws from it. For example, the idea of Lebanese military units replacing Israeli military units as zones in southern Lebanon are cleared of Hezbollah fighters is one we recommended. I gotta say that implementing this agreement is going to be very, very, very difficult. Iran and Hezbollah have made it clear that they oppose the agreement and oppose any move to disarm Hezbollah. The Lebanese army isn't strong enough to disarm this Iran-backed militia militarily, which enjoys strong support in Lebanon, in Lebanon's large Shia Muslim community. Iran and Hezbollah have said that they won't even consider disarmament until Israel is 100% out of Lebanon. Israel has said it has no intention of leaving Lebanon completely until Hezbollah is completely disarmed, something it's not been able to bring about through its own military campaign, which has displaced over a million Lebanese from their homes. It's killed over 4,000 Lebanese civilians, injured maybe three times that that number, and totally demolished villages and towns close to Israel. The wording of the framework agreement is sufficiently vague for both the Lebanese government to claim that Israeli forces should be completely out once southern Lebanon, not the entire country, is cleared of Hezbollah, and for Israel to claim that it doesn't need to give up its buffer zone in southern Lebanon until Hezbollah is completely disarmed in all of Lebanon. And finally, this agreement has no chance at all of implementation unless there's a very robust and well-resourced third party capable of overseeing the implementation and, if necessary, compelling certain steps. The U.S. has assigned this role to itself. But I'm seeing no evidence that Washington has actually committed itself to what's going to be a very, very heavy lift in Lebanon.
We will continue on that and talk more on our other side, on the other side of our break. That was an amazing encapsulation. We will continue with the roundtable. First, we'll take a break, get news with Ray Graff. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the roundtable. I apologize for the pause. We are waiting. There are Supreme Court decisions that are coming in as we speak, and there's a big one that I wanted to make sure that I had the wording correct before I announced it. That is that the Supreme Court has issued a ruling on one of the most consequential election cases in years. Ray touched on this in his newscast as well. A challenge that could eliminate the grace periods more than a dozen states use to count mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. In the 5-4 majority opinion, the sharply divided court ruled that federal Election Day statutes do not preempt a Mississippi law that allows mail-in ballots to be counted after the election. The Mississippi law allows mail-in ballots as long as they are postmarked and received within 5 days of Election Day. On allowance, the court said in its Monday opinion, is within the rights afforded to the state by the Constitution.
Yeah, so that's a big victory for largely the left. It'll be interesting.
Democracy?
Democracy.
Democracy. Yeah. I mean, the majority of mail-in ballots are not left.
How about the Constitution? Bo, I totally get what you're saying. That tactically, in the short run, it is a victory for the left. But it's a victory for, I don't know, words in the Constitution.
Military members?
I don't think you need to school me on the Constitution, Mark.
But go right ahead anyway.
Of course it's a victory for the Constitution. It's also a victory for federalism, right? I'm going to guess, having not read the opinion, I'm going to guess that at least two of the conservatives in a 5-4 decision are going to base it largely on federalism, this idea that states get to dictate their own political and electoral laws. That's a big deal. What I meant by the left is that it has been, I'm sure the four in the minority, and Joe, you can read who's in the minority, are going to be four of the conservatives, and they're going to be irritated by this. At the end of the day, it is a victory for democracy, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I don't know that I can read that.
And I think
information. Yeah, but go ahead.
If I could just add, as a practical matter, I would a free piece of advice to anybody who is mailing in a ballot through U.S. Postal Service, get the postal clerk to date stamp the envelope.
But it's interesting because this is the moment. I'll leave it up to the four of you to comment. This is in this moment. My first reaction was, I'm surprised by that outcome, but I'm also calculating how it's going to affect the midterms and the way in which I would imagine the Trump administration will say that there's fraud in this moment. Oh, the Supreme Court let the states do what they want to do. I ultimately think that this might not be the best thing for the story, the narrative of stability in elections. That said, I'm thrilled with the outcome.
But that's also saying like that nobody can do anything about anything, right? I mean,
no, true.
I mean, like, then, all right, nothing's going to work.
No, well,
right.
But the strong people who manage elections in my little village in Valencia would not let anybody push them around to say that their handling of elections is somehow in question. And I think that, you know, the more we recognize that, you know, there isn't fraud in our election system, the more people look at their local people who take responsibility and volunteer their time is so important to democracy.
By the way, I totally understand what you meant. Your initial reaction was sort of the tactical version. I was suggesting you didn't know what's in the Constitution. I will say, given some of the recent decisions, the conservatives seem perfectly willing to literally misread the simple words of the Constitution at will in order to manage the result they want. And I think the case around the protections for Syrians and Haitians, just read that for anybody who's interested. Kagan's dissent is brilliant, and it's Orwellian, not in a 1984 sense, but in the sense of simple writing, that words mean what they should and you need to get to the point. And if you want to celebrate the 4th of July, by the way, just pull up that dissent and the majority decision and skim the majority decision. It's a little bit long. And read the dissent, and you will feel better about this country that a woman of, I guess, I think it was like Jewish Russian heritage on the Supreme Court. I don't know if our founding fathers would be happy or surprised by that. I'm not sure. But I think it's brilliant that someone like that still has the position within the United States to searingly cut to the cynicism that's expressed by, sadly, the majority. But the one thing I don't get is Trump's going to lose the House. I mean, the thought that he would prevail, it's so unlikely. So I guess what he's setting up is a battle for a few marginal seats and maybe the Senate, where he's going to come in with his, you know, where Tulsi Gabbard or at least her those who follow after her are going to roll in and try to seize ballots. And they're going to try to steal a couple Senate seats and a couple House of Representative seats. I just don't get what's afoot for the midterms. And the one thing I really I don't understand what they're doing. I'm sure Chuck Schumer doesn't understand it and isn't planning for it, which makes me really afraid. But I just don't get what's afoot and what it is that the Democrats should be doing to counter it.
I might be misunderstanding you, Mark, but I'll tell you, the what's afoot is the slow, and I'll admit that it's slow, the slow erosion of popular sovereignty in the United States. Now, people ask me all the time, like, is our republic gone? No, of course the republic's not gone yet. But the slow erosion of popular sovereignty, the slow erosion of democracy as we understand it, is a bad trend. And so regardless of whether or not Trump loses the House, which he will, I would be surprised if the Democrats have fewer than a 25 or 30 seat majority after the midterms. The idea that it's more and more difficult for people to vote. It's more and more difficult for people to express their opinion on particular issues or candidates. That to me is what is troubling afoot.
But I don't think Trump has a long-term plan. I think his plan to meddle with the vote doesn't go beyond his time in office.
And yet he's willing, one more thing and then
sure,
I'll
please.
Stop. And yet he's willing to stomp on, for lack of a better term, stomp on John Thune for not bringing the Save America Act to the Senate, even though Thune, who is a very rational Republican, Thune knows he doesn't have the votes, right? So if I was to take Trump at his word, the Save America Act, which makes it more difficult for people to vote, is his biggest domestic policy agenda item, and that is problematic from an erosion.
But do you think you're going to hear word two about the Save America Act after the midterms?
No, but right.
So, anybody else? Okay, we're going to get back to Fred, I promise, in a moment.
Sorry.
I just wanted to the other Supreme Court announcement. Supreme Court has lets the $5 million sex abuse verdict against Trump stand. President Trump had asked the justices to intervene after a jury found that he had sexually abused and defamed the writer E. Jean Carroll. The Supreme Court on Monday declined the request by President Trump to review a $5 million civil judgment against him after a jury found in 2023 that he sexually abused and defamed the writer E. Jean Carroll. The announcement by the justices did not include any reasoning and no public dissents were noted.
Wow.
So that's
good.
Is as that is as well. I'll just in the shameless self-promotion column here category. There we interviewed E. Jean Carroll less than a year ago, and if you have a chance, if you have not heard it and you have a chance to listen to it, yeah. It's online. It is it's an amazing conversation. She's, mm-hmm. She's an amazing woman, and it's an amazing conversation. All right. So, Fred, you were saying.
Yeah, where I left off, Joe, was by saying I'm not seeing any evidence yet that the United States is prepared to do a real heavy lift in Lebanon, one that's going to require a lot of strategic patience, persistence, willingness to compel certain actions. In fact, one senior American official told me over the weekend that people close to President Trump think that the name Donald J. Trump on the framework agreement, and it's there, the last sentence, thanks, President Trump, for saving the world. They think that his name on the agreement is going to be enough to guarantee its implementation. And I can guarantee it will not. So to sum up, the agreement, at best, the agreement reached on Friday ideally will be a precursor to something like the agreement my Canadian colleague and I have drafted after listening to dozens and dozens and dozens of Israelis and Lebanese. Less than ideally, some combination of Iranian and Hezbollah opposition, some of it violent, Israeli inflexibility, Lebanese government and army weakness, and American inattention will cause this framework agreement to fail. My colleague and I, for sure, we'll do what we can as non-officials to prevent the worst from happening. But what we can do is obviously limited. We'll probably be headed back to the region second half of July.
You had questions?
I have lots of questions. I'll keep it to a minimum. One is, I was curious, Fred, you started by saying most Americans are not as, and this is your term, obsessively focused on this particular issue. We should be, shouldn't we be? It occurs to me that in that region and with the U.S.-Iran military, that the Israeli-Lebanese linchpin is the critical sort of key thing that you have to resolve. Is it not true that without some resolution with that, you're not going to get a long-term stability with Iran in the first place?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the first article in the Memorandum of Understanding with Iran makes it very clear, and this was a key Iranian demand accepted by the United States, that an end to the fighting, a true ceasefire, includes Lebanon. Okay. Iran has tried very, 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 very hard to insert itself as the savior of the Lebanese people, even though it was Iranian decisions that have brought massive death and destruction to the Lebanese community that they would like to represent. You know, in terms of Americans paying more attention to the issue, sure. I'd like to see it. as a as a practical matter, it's not going to happen unless really something blows up in our face. I mean, it's bad enough for Israelis and for Lebanese,
sure.
But this sort of stuff has been going on for the better part of 6 decades, yeah. Starting with Palestinian resistance movement,
right.
Operating independently of the government of Lebanon, and then, since the 1980s, Hezbollah operating independently of the Lebanese government.
Right. I mean, I think Bo's right that this is a piece of a larger geopolitical puzzle, and that it demands our attention.
Yep.
When is the Israeli election? I mean, I think
October.
The unspoken piece of all of what we've been talking about is how Israel is going to make its decisions, because they're not party to this. I mean, they're party to the framework.
They're party to the framework
that was signed on Friday,
but not to that.
And yeah. You can't have things decided in Lebanon without the Lebanese participation.
Yeah.
I mean, we found that out in many other situations, that you can't talk about a sovereign state.
Yeah, the electoral challenges of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, weigh heavily on all of this for a variety of reasons. The Prime Minister wants to present himself as Israel's Mr. Security, as the Prime Minister willing to reach anywhere to inflict a violent end on people who threaten the security of Israel. And on this particular issue, I mean, Bibi, as a general matter, is quite unpopular, mm-hmm. in Israel now. His ratings are I think down in the 30s. But between 70% and 80% of the Israeli public has opposed any kind of a ceasefire, yeah. in Lebanon.
Yeah.
They probably oppose this framework agreement, and Bibi is trying his best to tap into that without alienating President Trump completely.
So the structure that you've played out for us is that the official state actor, Lebanese army, takes over, disarms Hezbollah, keeps security in southern Lebanon, presumably, although this is good for election, you just said for election reasons, Bibi's probably not going to do this, but presumably the Israeli forces retreat back to the border.
Right.
Right. My fundamental question is, how does that change the 62%, which is between 60% and 70% of Israelis think that there should be a battle? There should continue to be Israeli participation in southern Lebanon. Mm-hmm. How does that change public opinion if there's some movement in disarming Hezbollah and Israel agrees to retreat?
Yeah, it's a fine question, Bowen. It goes to the essence of the challenge here. Obviously, this is going to be more than a 20-minute operation.
Yeah.
This is going to unfold over months, with the Lebanese army focusing on southern Lebanon. I mean, disarming Hezbollah in the entire country, that's, ooh. Another issue entirely. That's going to take quite a while. But focusing on southern Lebanon, if the Lebanese army is able to display competence, thoroughness, one of the things we've recommended they do to change the conditions is, as they deploy to the south, they enter villages that are going to be repopulated, garrison those villages. Mm-hmm. Their problem in the past is that Hezbollah ran those villages,
yeah, right.
and the army was on the outside,
right.
having either to ask permission or fight its way in to, remove weapons and so forth, or occasionally having the cooperation of Hezbollah. They need to be inside the villages. So I think over time, I wouldn't dismiss the possibility of Israeli public opinion, and perhaps under the leadership of a different prime minister, coming to the conclusion, these Lebanese truly do want to secure their side of the border from these non-state actors, and they're doing a pretty good job. And if the government of Israel is willing to testify to that, I think Israeli public opinion can change fundamentally.
I got another question.
Okay, go ahead. you have another question. We have 2 minutes.
Okay, so the group, have you seen the Hezbollah weakened even the slightest bit? Because here you have three players, right? Unlike traditional military activity, where you only have two players, you have two state actors, you have the non-state actor Hezbollah.
And it's also part of the government of Lebanon.
Right, true. But you guys said during the break that the president and prime minister of Lebanon are trying their best.
Yes.
So is the Lebanese army even remotely equipped to do what you're doing, and Hezbollah's weakened a little bit?
Hezbollah's weakened a bit, but the performance of the Lebanese army depends on what it does. If the president of Lebanon tries to unleash the army on Hezbollah, it's not going to work. Can the army defend itself adequately if attacked by these guys? Yes, I believe it can.
Maybe.
No, I believe it can. It's a professional army, but it's
also to take the pressure off the army from the Israel side, so that they aren't fighting a two-front war, right? Because right now Hezbollah is really the only security guarantee that Lebanon has in the south.
And unfortunately, Israeli tactics are helping Hezbollah recover its reputation, and I guess that's an unintended consequence.
Yeah.
We just have less than a minute. I do want to say that the Supreme Court has blocked President Trump's removal of the Fed Governor Lisa Cook. And Cook, a Federal Reserve Board of Governor member, and the court ruled against Trump in his effort to remove Cook, leaving her on the central bank's board while her lawsuit continues. So that is another decision that comes out today, which is a fairly big deal.
Nothing yet on birthright citizenship.
No, that will not be done today.
That's not okay.
Not today. So we will take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Busy morning this morning, and we thank you for being with us. What an amazing panel. We have Ambassadors Fred Hoff and Donna Welton, as well as Mark Whitman and Bo Breslin. And we thank all of you for being here and for a very lively conversation on lots of issues. I do want to go to a story in regards. This was in the New York Times yesterday, where the headline is, Trump cut a billion-dollar mining deal, his sons stand to profit. An agreement between the U.S. and Kazakhstan had given a group of American investors with ties to the president and the commerce secretary access to one of the world's largest untapped reserves of tungsten. Now, this is a... I think it's an amazing story. But when Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick met with Kazakhstan's president at the St. Regis Hotel last September in New York, President Trump jumped in by phone as the men sealed a deal on a top priority for Washington. During the call, Mr. Trump and his team won an agreement from the leader to give a little-known American company access to one of the world's largest untapped reserves of tungsten, a metal that the U.S. desperately needs for the production of missile warheads, fighter jets, computer chips, and other critical goods. Ahead of the deal, the Trump administration approved preliminary applications for as much as $1.6 billion in federal financing for the American company, now called Kaz Resources, which plans to break ground on the project in rural Kazakhstan. It was not only Mr. Trump and Mr. Lutnick who saw an opportunity. Their sons were soon doing business with partners in a deal that their fathers were negotiating, continuing a pattern of self-enrichment in the second Trump administration that has few precedents in American history. All right.
Oh, right. It's a very deeply reported story. And it certainly traces where the money is, which is of course the core of all good investigative journalism. It's interesting to me because it on the surface, if you just looked at the project, it fits within the parameters of what the Development Finance Corporation does. So that is a part of U.S. aid that leverages private finance. So it provides the guarantees. It's sort of like it underwrites the insurance, and they do projects all around the world. But it's whose private finance it's leveraging is the big question, right? So the project to have a government money guarantee of a mining development for critical minerals, which is in the U.S. interest to fight PRC dominance in that area, that's in the U.S. interest. So it checks all the boxes for the right mission, but who profits from it? Who is the private financing that the U.S. government is leveraging is like insider trading on steroids. It's unbelievable. It gives you a new sense of what public service means. it's just... Kazakhstan's all rural. There's just, I mean, everybody lives in these small, it has the one of the largest territories in the world. It's the largest landlocked country in the world. But it's per capita, per square mile, is one of the lowest in the world.
Mark, you brought this to my attention a couple weeks ago. And
actually, back in April. There was a really obscure report.
That long ago? Yeah, okay, yeah. All right.
It takes a while for these things.
It seems like only yesterday.
There was an obscure report in the Financial Times about the Trump family, basically the sons, and their links to an investment vehicle that seemed to be chasing around U.S. government initiatives.
Yeah, yes.
And frankly, it looked like they were opening. You know, there was an opening in the door. Right now, those boys. From the appearances of this, have hey Kool-Aid Man right through the side of the wall. They didn't even bother with the door. And this, I mean, this just smells so bad, right? And I'm please keep me out of jail or from being sued for slander. But so let's just say, if nothing else, this violates the appearance of impropriety, right?
Yeah.
And a couple things. Number one, I hold Mitch McConnell accountable because he held open the door on that one appointment to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court then goes on to tell Trump, well, you maybe have some bonus immunity that is nowhere else in the Constitution but in our imaginations. And Trump has said reportedly to people, well, if this is beyond the lines, in his second term, he's reportedly said to people while in the Oval Office, if this is outside the lines, I'll just pardon you. Anybody who thinks that Donald Trump isn't going to offer a blanket pardon to his family for all this stuff. And I also, frankly, I blame Joe Biden for it as well, for setting that precedent. You can't get him off the hook. But all these boys, you know, the Comers and the Jordans who were, I mean, what Hunter Biden did was unseemly. But what he did in terms of getting payments from the government, there was nothing, quote unquote, illegal there, right? If a phone call about the weather from your father during a meeting with investors merits the type of investigation that those cats did, right, where in the world are the Republicans now looking for corruption? This stinks to high heaven, and someone needs to be looking into it other than just the New York Times. And if you want to then link this up to what we've been talking about, if you want to know why Trump is worried about the midterms, this is it, because once the Democrats get hold of the House, this isn't just like maybe we should impeach Joe Biden because he called his son about the weather. Yeah. This is like maybe his sons are really breaking the law in a very serious way. But again, anybody who doesn't think that Donald Trump is going to inoculate everybody on his way out is missing the punchline here.
Yeah, I would say if the Democrats take one or both houses of Congress in the midterms, at the very least, you'll have committee hearings.
Yeah.
All right. Sure. That falls short of an indictment in the form of impeachment, but committee hearings on these. And Mark, you're right. I mean, the New York Times boiled it all down. They characterized it as an ethically tangled pursuit of profits, unquote.
That's a mild understatement involving
the Trump and Lutnick families. And as you point out, you know, in the Biden administration, there were similar ethical issues raised by the efforts of Hunter Biden and others to take advantage of the person occupying the Oval Office. And I thought at the time it was perfectly okay for Republicans to decry Hunter Biden's ethically tangled pursuit of profits, and for the Justice Department to investigate. But where are the safeguards now? Where are the institutional safeguards now? Is the Department of Justice under current management going to look into this ethically tangled pursuit of profits to determine if laws have been broken?
I got a solution.
I've been waiting for this.
I have got a solution.
Is it constitutional?
It's a constitutional solution. Okay. Unfortunately, it requires a constitutional amendment. But I'll keep people waiting. Patronage has been part of the American equation for a long time, right? The access to power yields commercial gain, financial gain, is not surprising. It surprised me a little bit that the New York Times said this was unprecedented. And maybe the brazenness is as unprecedented. And I agree with Mark and Fred and Donna about the fact that, you know, Hunter Biden's a little bit different. But how many of you remember Neil Bush, right? Neil Bush is George H.W. Bush's son, yeah. Who had the savings bank scandal and also pursued lucrative consulting contracts back when dad was in office. Access to power yields financial gain.
Don't forget Billy Beer.
Of course, right? The list is pretty long, actually. Here's my solution. And I'm sure listeners are going to rip Joe in terms of letters, but I think you have to have a age limitation for the president. Because it's sort of tongue in cheek, but at the end of the day, John F. Kennedy's kids were not using access because they were 10 and 11 years old, and or 4 and 5, whatever John and Caroline were at the time. The country is run at the presidential level by people who are out of touch largely. And I would include Joe Biden in that situation and Donald Trump in that with that. Obama's kids were young. So, is it silly? Sure, it's a little silly. But the age limitation for the presidency serves a number of different purposes, not the least of which is that you don't have the kids who are accessing power in the White House. It's a little tongue-in-cheek.
It's well said. Well said. But it doesn't explain Lutnick. You know, I mean, there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that it's not just the Trump family, but it echoes out from that. But it's so many of the secretaries, so many of other people in government, and loose advisors who are just profiting, taking our taxpayers' money hand over fist.
If there's a good guy in the story, Joe, it's aside from the New York Times and the Financial Times, financial reporting for as mundane as that sounds,
which, by the way,
the current Trump administration is also trying to dilute down. But I presume 90% of what we know is because it was revealed through mandatory financial reporting,
right.
And thank God for that safeguard here.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Okay, we'll take a break. We'll finish up the show, and then we'll get to our special, We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250. All of that and more coming up. First, this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we are finishing up this morning with the World Cup and the impact of the World Cup. When does it end? When are we?
July.
Late July.
19?
Late July. We have a full month of fun. So we're there.
Absolutely.
We wanted to talk about the impact and what this is and of the nations and the dreams and how all this is going. Mark Whitman.
Well, I'm a big fan, and if you haven't caught it or aren't watching the news on it, I would reiterate my assertion that you definitely should. First of all, the expanded tournament has been a big boon, right? You've got Cape Verde, 500,000 people, and they're now in the knockout range. I mean, obviously, you know, the bell will toll and their slipper will fall off, but in the meantime, let's all enjoy the ball. It's great, great fun. And Africa's done really well in the Cup this year, and hopefully will continue to do so. So that's great to see. Having three nations host it, despite the fact that this is probably Donald Trump's nightmare, has been a beautiful thing. They didn't have to build any extra stadiums. And all three hosts have seemed to have acquitted themselves quite well here. So that's all worked out. I will say I learned something about international football that was really impactful. And I talked with my family about it. I watched a opposing player on a team or a player on a team get red carded for saying something to his opponent while covering his mouth. And the reason he did that, presumably, was because back when there were big issues with racism in European football, particularly in Premier League in the UK, that was the way you communicated things that you didn't want to be lip-read. And the organization said, if we can't see what you're saying, you're off. He literally was thrown out of the game to the detriment of his team. I thought that was so beautiful. And frankly, the way that the Premier League and others in Europe have dealt with the issues around racism is still a model that, youth hockey in the United States should adopt. I mean, it takes a lot of time. It takes an institutional effort. But over time, you can reduce racism. And it was great to see that incident. I didn't initially understand what I was seeing. But it's the fruits of the labor of a lot of people working really hard to change people's views of one another. I also think there's just this great sense of everyone realizes that the competition between nations is everyone feels very emotional about it and is invested in their team, but it's respectful. Mm-hmm. And I still just think that's a great model that we miss both domestically and internationally. You can't have greatness without great interlocutors and great opponents. Just ask, Yankees Red Sox from the 90s about the fact that you're both better because that rivalry is so strong, right?
That's a tough one to go to.
So I for all those reasons and more, aside from the issues around Donald Trump mistreating the Iranian team and all the infirmities around FIFA, I just think it's a beautiful spectacle. And it's something worth keeping up with and watching, even if you're not a football/soccer fan.
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to separate FIFA out of this because they're not exact. They're a model for many things, but not for sportsmanship. But I do think the expansion particularly is remarkable because it's much more global. It's not just the powerhouses, and you get teams like Cabo Verde being able to good small island state that speaks Portuguese just like my country did. I think it's just great to have that happening in the United States this year. I was, in the city, and it was in New York City, and it was filled with fans, and people were interacting. Everyone loves the story of the Scottish team being welcomed, and certainly the Iranians being treated well in Los Angeles. There's quite a lot of that. Even the Canadians are behaving. It's pretty cool.
I think it's a feel-good story, Mark. I agree that that we've things have worked out better than I expected. Ticket prices were high. People were sort of a little going in, but the stadiums seem filled. And I'll say a couple things. One is, can an underdog break through? Right? Is it gonna be the the Frances of the world and the Germanys and the Brazils and the Portugal of the world, like Morocco did a few years ago when they made it to the semifinals. I think that would make a difference. The U.S.'s chances, you know, I'm not a football connoisseur, but if the U.S. gets, I think the U.S. will beat Bosnia-Herzegovina next, but if the U.S. gets to the quarterfinals, does it start to feel a little like the U.S. in 1980 with the hockey team? Maybe not. Maybe that's a one-time thing. But remember, and I played hockey in Rochester when I was growing up at that time, and hockey wasn't a big deal in 1980 and around the country in the same way that soccer is not a huge deal here. So we need a patriotic moment. Could the U.S. maybe make it to the quarterfinals and be and exceed expectations and make it an even better feel-good story? I don't know. I'm going to guess that no, and that ultimately the Frances and Germanys and Portugals and Argentinas are going to triumph.
Correct. Yeah, I confess I am not an international football soccer fan, but having said that, I've been in two or three establishments where the matches have been shown up on the big screen, and I must say the enthusiasm is contagious. It really is. It's something. Yeah. And my only substantive problem with this whole thing is why in the name of God does it have to take place during baseball season?
That's a great
point,
Fred.
You can't watch two screens at the same time?
Oh. No, I walked into – I'll use Fred's words. I walked into – an establishment over the weekend, and I was hoping that the Mets Phillies game would be on, and on all the screens was the
World Cup.
Canada. Yeah. Who was Canada playing?
South Africa.
That's
South
right.
Africa.
So, yeah. South Africa. Canada won. So yeah, but. I agree with you. It would have been nice.
Yes.
And by the way, you know, there's eight screens, 4-4. 6-2, even.
Why
I don't
not?
Care.
Why not?
7-1, as long as the Phillies match.
I mean, they lost anyway, but it was still like, no, they won yesterday. That's right. They won yesterday. Lost 2 days.
The U.S. has its glass slipper, but it's maybe it doesn't fall off at midnight, but it'll fall off at 1 a.m. But I actually think that's one of the beauties of the World Cup and why, when my son was young, I encouraged him to watch. I used to buy him jerseys from a couple of countries that I thought would make a deep run. Because I think it's good for us in the United States to realize that we're not always the center of the world. And right. and so right. and we don't have to be. It's okay to participate and enjoy the fun that the rest of the world is having rooting right. for their teams. That doesn't always have to be about us in the U.S.
Now, I must say my grandkids love getting jerseys of soccer greats from various countries, and they and their amount of knowledge, who this is, what has this person done, it's incredible.
Yeah, I forget how old the top goal scorer Lionel Messi is. Like
he's
38, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and he is still probably arguably the premier player in the tournament. I mean, the number of feel good stories, and he's about to face the Cape Verde Goldie, a man whose social media following famously went from 10,000 to in the millions because he at 40 has performed so well in this tournament thus far. And, you know, no matter who wins that match, it'll just be a heck of a lot of fun to watch it.
And I would say what's interesting about what's emerged for me from this particular World Cup is that Messi has a very legitimate claim to being the greatest football player of all time.
And he's still not that far off his prime in terms of his goal-scoring ability anyway. There's a funny story in the Wall Street Journal from years ago. It was Messi's last dance is more like a slow walk.
Yeah,
and they analyzed how he plays, but when he gets that ball, there's a reason they call him the magician.
All right. Well, we are out of time. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning. A great conversation. A lot of stuff that we got to talk about. Fred Hoff, Donna Welton, and Mark Whitman, thank you very much for being with us. Bo and I will stick around. We have our special coming up. We still hold these truths. America at 2:50, part one of a four-part special, which will air 11 a.m. over the next 4 days and begins in just about 2 minutes. So all of that and more. My thanks to all of you. Have a beautiful week and a beautiful weekend. We'll return right after this.